Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
This is your moment. Your time to shine. Your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
And welcome to another episode of 100 Words or Less, the podcast. I'm your host, Ray Harkins, bringing you another exciting, interesting, introspective conversation with someone who I define as important within the context of independent music. Thank you for joining us. If this is your first time listening to the show, thank you. This is awesome. I just love bringing new people into this little family. I truly do believe that everybody that joins up on this show, usually they don't listen to kind of just one episode. They kind of start to follow along and start to really become engaged in the show. So anyways, if this is your first episode, just come on in. And if this is your 153rd episode, you're the man or woman. The guest this week, I can't even believe I'm saying this because this was a bucket list guest. This is a person that I had put on my list at the very, very, very start of the show. And I was like, yeah, one of these days, maybe that'd be cool. Jim Adkins from Jimmy Eat World. The Jimmy Eat World and the Jim Adkins. I still can't believe that he was gracious enough to be like, oh yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So I need to give a very, very special thank you to my friend Steve, who promotes shows in the beautiful state of Arizona. I've known him forever. He was able to facilitate this, and I can't thank him enough for that. And obviously, I can't thank Jim enough for wanting to hang out with me for, you know, a good hour and a half on a nice afternoon. So anyways, let's get some business stuff out of the way. I'll talk about Jim. I'll give you some updates on other stuff that's happening with the show and myself and the interview. This month is extremely important to the show. This is our fundraising month. I have taken the public radio model, which is basically like, you know, 2 months. 2 months out of the year, I will bug the hell out of you to support this thing. And it's been great so far. Sometimes I feel bad because there are people who are kind of return donors, where it's like, these are people who have given me, honestly, over 100 plus bucks to keep this thing going. And I can't thank you enough for that. So thank you, Sam and Cameron, all these other people who have contributed to the show. I honestly can't thank you enough. That really, really means the world to me. So for those of you who listen to this on a semi-regular basis, I encourage you to do one of two things. One, you can be a regular contributing sponsor to the show, which means basically you're card is charged monthly, and that's it. It'll go directly into my bank account. I'll be able to pay my producer, Tom Richfield. It just makes the whole process a lot easier for me. So you can do that by going to patreon.com/xpurposex, or just click on the show notes of this show and you will be able to click directly through that. Or you can do a one-time donation, which a lot of you have been doing, and I'm very grateful for that. I don't care what amount you give. People have been giving $1. People are giving $5. Like I said, people have been giving $50. It's amazing. So you can do that by visiting 100wordspodcast.com. On the right side of the page, you'll be able to see a bright yellow button that says donate. So please do that, because I want to keep making this thing better for you. I want to be able to dedicate more time to it, more resources, all that stuff. Like I said, even if it's $1 or $2 a month, or even it's just a one-time donation of $1, gives me that confidence to keep moving on. And also this sort of financial stability where it's like, you know, I'm not pulling money out of my kids' college fund in order to keep this going. Cause honestly, I'd be doing this no matter what. So, and we're approaching, next month is the 3-year anniversary of this show. And I can't even believe how many hours I've invested in this thing. But yeah, anyways, that's either here or there. But please donate if you are a regular listener, or even if you just like this one particular episode. So anyways, enough of the plea. And I just got back from vacation myself, so my head's a little cloudy. I'm a little sick. The post-vacation sickness is kind of overtaking me. I went on a cruise, and those are awesome. And it was nice to kind of unplug for a minute. So I apologize for last week's episode being a little delayed in posting. Hopefully I will get back into the regular posting of things. And I mean, when I say regular, I mean like on time, like the Wednesday of when I promise you a new show. Enough about me, enough about fundraising. Jim Adkins. Jim Eat World is one of my favorite bands of all time. I have a tattoo of their lyrics on my body, and they are a band that in my mind really hasn't put out bad music pretty much their entire career, with the exception of their very, very first CD, which I own because I found randomly at some record store for cheap. And, you know, that's kind of just when they were, basically a terrible pop punkish band. But that's fine. Every record they've put out since, from Static Prevails to Clarity to Invented, like, their records are unbelievable. I measure my years as being really good if I get a new Jim Eat World release. There was a lot loaded into this conversation. And straight up, I was intimidated. And not so much because Jim is like a bad interview. I just, you know, it's those insecurities kind of leaping forward where it's like, oh man, what questions am I going to ask him that he hasn't been asked 400,000 times before? And maybe I'm just like too close to the matter and too close to the subject, but I really always try to focus on that when I'm doing the research for these interviews, because I don't want this to just be another interview. I don't want this to kind of be like, oh yeah, here's another thing, going through the motions. How's your new record? Are you guys writing stuff? Like, I get bored just even thinking about that. So let alone even asking those questions. So I had a laundry list of these kind of really chunky questions. And then honestly, about in the middle of the conversation, you'll probably be able to hear the actual break where I kind of threw a lot of those questions away. And Jim and I just started to kind of dig into things. And it was really, really interesting for me to hear his responses on a lot of these things and just kind of the difference between the outsider's perspective, which is my perspective, and then his perspective, where it's like, oh yeah, like this is kind of what we were doing when that thing was happening. So anyways, without further ado, here is the discussion with Jim Adkins. I still can't even believe I'm saying that. And I will talk to you after the conversation is over.
What's wrong, baby? Don't they treat you like they should? Did you take them for it? Well, every penny that you could. We once walked out.
I was trying to count how many times I've seen you guys perform, and it numbers over 30, because you guys obviously played Southern California a lot in the earlier years and then even now. But a show that kind of stuck out to me in the early years was I saw you guys at the Living Room up in Santa Barbara, California. I think you were on tour with Fluff, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, right.
The reason that show stands out to me is because I think that was the first time where you guys kind of ellipsed in my own head a, you know, I'm sure this is what you were going for, but it coveted one of my favorite bands of all time spots. And I don't know what it was about that particular show, but it just kind of like locked it into me where it's like, yeah, I'm going to be listening to these guys for pretty much the rest of my life. Would you reflect on those sort of like earlier tours? Because obviously at that point you were, you know, getting established, but when you reflect on that time, what sort of emotions, you know, get brought up in your own head?
Well, I think like the earlier days of touring, and especially like the first couple of years that we were a band, it's all still pretty fresh to me. It doesn't seem like it's ever that long ago. I mean, like the friends that we met, stayed in contact with, I'm still in pretty regular communication with a lot of the other people that were in bands that we, you know, got to be friends with from around that time. You know, it doesn't feel like it's that long ago, to tell you the truth, although so much is changed, you know, everything has changed. It's all pretty fresh. It wasn't the first living room. It was like the second incarnation of living room, I think. And I think it was us, No Knife, and Fluff doing a West Coast tour. It's like I remember everything about like what that, because it it was just like I can't remember somebody I met 2 weeks ago, but I remember stuff like that. Every lyric to "And Justice for All," or every Propaganda lyric, I remember that from when I was in high school. But I don't remember people, you know, somebody I met 2 weeks ago.
I'm very impressed at the fact that you were able to place that it was the second living room, because yes, that you are indeed correct.
Yeah, we did do a show. I think we were playing house parties in Santa Barbara. Yeah, California right. is the spot that, like, you know, we were based out of like the Phoenix area in Arizona. That's, you know, San Diego, LA. It's just really the closest thing you can hit if you want to try to get out of town. So we would do that a lot.
Right. Well, because you weren't having aspirations to be like, hey, let's go to Albuquerque, because obviously that wasn't really, I mean, it's a spot where bands play obviously now, but at that juncture, there wasn't much going on there.
Yeah, we tried to play Albuquerque a lot. You know, we would do, our plan was that we would try to just do music first. And then it was like, well, how do we do that? Well, let's book our own little regional kind of like loop, and let's go to California and go up as far as we can go and then come back. And then it was like, well, let's try to go in the other way. And we would go up to Denver and then Kansas City and then maybe back through Texas and then back home. Albuquerque would be on that sometimes, but I mean, it was rough for us there for a while.
Right. That's awesome. Well, I'm glad those memories obviously still loom large in your head, and it's not like a distant faded memory. But you yourself, kind of backing up, you were born and raised in Mesa, and I've grandmother who lives in Phoenix, and I've spent a lot of time in that area. And then also, like, I played in bands for years and played a lot of shows within that general area and in Mesa as well. Mesa just strikes me as just obviously just, you know, a suburb of obviously Phoenix. Is that reflective of the time when you were growing up there? Just kind of, you know, sort of suburban life, as it were?
Yeah. I mean, the place where we all grew up, I mean, back then, most of it was Citrus. I mean, now it's like completely like developed into strip mall insanity sprawl. But back then it was kind of the edge of things. Yeah. But just, you know, it was just a suburb of the Phoenix metropolitan area. And the way the cities are here, it's like Southern California, you know, like where you cross through one municipality into the other and you don't realize you've gone into a new town, you know, like they're just bumped up next to each other. I don't know. There wasn't a whole lot of identity there. It's just like this, whatever.
It's just, right. It's just a city.
It's just a city, man. You know, like,
and so, and you are the oldest of your family as far as siblings are concerned, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My brother is like 3.5 years younger than me.
And so it's just you two in the house as far as, and then what did your, what were your parents doing as you were growing up as far as their jobs and stuff like that were concerned?
My father's a veterinarian.
So is my stepfather.
Yeah. So we probably have a similar life experience of, character building assignment of hosing out stalls then.
Absolutely. I did, however, have the trump card of I'm allergic to a lot of pets, so I didn't have to do too much, but exactly what you're talking about, I 100% had to do that too. Was there ever any, gleam in his eye in regards to you taking up the practice?
No, there's never any. I mean, they're supportive of me and my brother doing whatever. It's not exactly like a trade you pass down. You know, it's a profession, and it's really tough to get into. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, if I showed an aptitude for it, they would have definitely encouraged me, but it wasn't like there was a pressure to do something in medicine or veterinary medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And was your mom at home taking care of you guys?
Yeah. I mean, she would do occasionally like jobs here and there, like teaching every once in a while or accounting for my dad's practice.
Dude, it sounds like, that's my mom currently still does my father's books, even though it's like by this point he should have hired somebody else, but It's like, all right, I guess she's been doing it for so long.
Yeah, yeah. My mom helps out with the practice kind of a lot. That's sort of her main thing.
You know, as you were, you know, kind of growing up in that area and matriculating through elementary school and stuff like that, what kind of kid did you find yourself being? Were you, you know, super into sports? Were you kind of an indoor kid? Were you, you know, into art? Where would you place yourself?
I was average all around. You know, I just explored aptitudes and hung out with basically with whatever group of kids I was buddies with at the time. You know, I played basketball, I skated. I was never like really great at either of those, but I was okay enough to yeah. speak the common language with my peer group and get along. Yeah, no, I mean, it wasn't really until high school, or well, actually it was until about junior high that I kind of started mingling with the music people.
And so you strike me as the type of person too, like if I obviously didn't know your history and know where your band is from and everything like that, you would strike me as like the sort of quintessential Southern California dude, as far as just like a, yeah man, I'm just kind of laid back and chill. Like it seems like that kind of was obviously always how you were, or is that just something that you've kind of, you know, settled into now?
I wouldn't really like classify myself like that, but I would say that coming from the environment that we came from, we definitely didn't and still don't take things very seriously.
Right.
Maybe it's not a lack of caring or being proud of our work. It's just that, come on, dude, really?
What about the characterization of being kind of a quintessential Southern California person? Like, so would you define yourself as chill, or do you get pretty anxious when it comes to certain things?
I think we all get anxious about certain things, but I wouldn't.
True.
I wouldn't say true. That. No. It takes a lot to really get me stressed out about an occurrence.
Sure.
I failed to see the need to expend energy on a lot of things that seem to stress out people.
The old adage of don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah, it's just a lot of things seem a lot smaller to me than a lot of other people. I mean, I'd say that's fair.
So then, as you started to you know, like I said, grow up and kind of form an identity. You've mentioned in previous interviews that sort of, you know, theatrical metal, as it were, was something that you were interested in from, like, you know, Quiet Riot and Def Leppard and all that sort of stuff. Was it just the sheer, like, grandiosity of what it was that they were doing that was like, this shit rules, man? Or was it, like, just the fact that you kind of wanted to shred in some capacity?
I think it was just the MTV aspect of it all.
Well, yeah, sure. These guys rule.
And was it, that was the initial exposure, like, via MTV of just like, wow, that's, like, the music videos and everything
yeah.
like that?
Yeah, it was just like, you know, the Welcome to the Thunderdome Scorpions video and Def Leppard guy running around with a sword, like the countless airplane hangar videos with like a million park hands and dudes just, you know, looking ridiculous, rocking out.
Sure.
Pretty much the giant wave that came over the crowd during Duran Duran's Reflex is what made me want to be in music.
I like how you could distill it down to that one particular moment. Yeah. It was like, yeah, that's where it switched.
Yeah. So, I mean, but all that was like, dude, I should play guitar. That looks rad.
Right. That looks fun.
Yeah. And back then, you know, that was probably like, God, I don't know, second grade, third grade, maybe.
Okay.
I was playing piano. And that, after I saw all that stuff, my dad played guitar. So that's kind of what made me want to explore guitar.
So that was just kind of kicking around the house. You would just, you know, fiddle with it. And that was kind of interesting because you saw that in conjunction with obviously the fact that sweet bands played guitar too.
Yeah, he could play, but it was definitely a hobby.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different things that stress us out, right? Like maybe it's something really, really small, like, man, that parking space, it's always taken. And I wish that I would be able to like get it instead of, you know, this person that maybe, you know, is the most courteous and considerate. I know that's something very random, but it's true. We all experience different things throughout the day that trigger us in so many different ways. And there are many times where I have been like, I wish that I had a spot or a repository for me to, you know, get this stuff off of my chest. Because if you bottle it up, that is no bueno. And then all of a sudden you explode on a coworker or a friend or a family member being like, the parking spot. And people are like, what are you talking about? That is where therapy comes in. And I love working with BetterHelp because I'm a huge advocate for therapy, broadly speaking. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, please give BetterHelp a try. It is so easy because it's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you do is fill out a brief questionnaire and then you get matched with a licensed therapist. And if you are not vibing with the therapist for any reason, you can switch it out at no additional charge. Get things off of your chest with BetterHelp. So visit betterhelp.com/Ray today to get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/Ray.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Right, right. Where did the kind of exposure into more, you know, for lack of a better term, like independent music from, you know, whatever, punk, hardcore, that sort of stuff, when did that start to, you know, infiltrate you? Was it via, you know, high school or friends that kind of existed?
Yeah. 'Cause
as an older sibling, you didn't have that older brother kind of being like, yo, here's your starter kit, man.
No, not really. I mean, I would pick things up like from the skate buddies that I had. I would pick up some things, you know. Violent Femmes were definitely an early one in there. And actually, I have a cousin who lives in Nebraska that we would visit. All my family's from Nebraska. So we'd go back there for summers and Christmases. And, you know, one of my cousins was a little bit older than me, like, he's probably the guy who turned me on to like all the Discord stuff and like the hip Omaha local bands.
Right. I was gonna say like you would never define the cultural hub of being in Nebraska, like that you would travel there to be exposed to DC hardcore.
yeah, no, but that's how it happened, you know.
Where in Nebraska? Was it in Omaha?
Yeah, or? Omaha.
That's funny that you had to take a pilgrimage and that was the exposure that you got there. Once your parents started to, I know you mentioned earlier that your parents were obviously supportive of your musical interests, but was there ever any things that you started to kind of bring home that made your parents you know, cause for concern, so to speak?
Maybe Twisted Sisters Stay Hungry. They weren't really into the album cover on that. They thought that was like a little out there. Yeah, I was never into obnoxious like shock rap. I mean, they probably didn't get the music I was listening to, but I was never, you know, I didn't seek out shock value things. If they were shocked at some of the more aggressive metal that I was listening to, like, you know, then they didn't really show it.
Right. they weren't one of those parents that obviously burst into your room and started to take records and you were like, wait a minute, what?
Definitely.
So did you start to try to adopt any of the aesthetic as far as the metal influence that was creeping into your life? You know, were you growing long hair and wearing you know, tight jeans and leather jackets and such?
No, I mean, I tried to grow long hair when I was in high school. That was more from like seeing bands like Faith No More.
Got it.
And I wanted Mike Patton's hair, dude. I wanted like long purple hair. Right. Is what I wanted. I remember from seeing them play Saturday Night Live and I was like, oh man, that's the raddest.
I love those moments that you can reflect on when it's like that single iconic thing where you see and you're like, that's what I'm going for. Like,
oh, sure. Yeah.
That's incredible. So yeah, obviously you did not accomplish that.
No. Yeah, that I grew out of that pretty quick. There's definitely, I mean, you gotta try stuff on to see how it feels. I think I did a pretty good job of paying attention to the data that comes back from that effort, altering my life to do something different.
I love the way you phrase that. The data, the feedback I was receiving from people. Okay, that's not working.
Well, you know, I think it's more like when I started playing guitar. I subscribed to all the guitar magazines And the Shredder dudes were like, you know, the people that I kind of looked up to, I guess, like the Satriani, Vi, Eric Johnson, whoever was on the cover of Guitar Hero. I mean, Guitar Player magazine was somebody that like I was like, oh, who is this? It was Yngwie Malmsteen. Like, I got to check that guy out. You know, it was sort of like, but I pretty quickly I realized I would never be a player like that. So I had to kind of alter my plan for myself in how I would push myself or challenge myself or my expectations for even pursuing this thing for myself. It's like, I'm not going to be that. What else can I do? Fortunately, around that time, I discovered like the indie stuff that was floating around, and that just kind of spoke to me. So, and it seemed like more attainable.
Yeah, you could kind of reach out and touch it, so to speak. It wasn't this, you know, I got to spend 10 years playing this guitar before I even get to, you know, a level where I can understand what these guys are doing.
Right.
And so this is something that's kicked around my head, where just because obviously since Jimmy Eat World has you've existed for so long, is technically Jimmy Eat World like your first band?
We had played around in groups with everybody like in high school and junior high. Yeah.
So technically you played shows prior to Jimmy Eat World. Like, what were you trying to accomplish with those first couple bands, as far as like whether it was sonically trying to emulate something, or was it just simply trying to, you know, play a show?
Goofy punk rock spaz, basically.
Okay.
There's always a fresh crop of 14-year-old guys having their first kind of punk rock experience out there, and not exactly understanding why it speaks to them, but just feeling this compulsion that they have to, they just feel that it's like, oh, I want to do that. Like, I don't know. It's hard to explain really, but it's just like this, it's compelling. You don't exactly know how to put it out there, but you're sure going to go for it. And I would say that's kind of what was happening at first for us.
Technically, what was your first show that you actually like played?
It was probably opening up for some punk band at the Mason Jar in Arizona. A matinee gig for like six people, basically.
Sure.
Our drummer's girlfriend and the other band's like kid manager.
Of course.
15-year-old manager who got them the matinee gig for nobody. So like, that was probably it.
Were you singing and playing guitar at the time in this punk band, as you put it?
No, I was doing backups maybe.
Okay.
Playing guitar. I didn't start singing until about a little bit into the band, into Jimmy World in high school.
You strike me just as, you know, this is a sheer projection, and obviously if I'm wrong, completely feel free to shoot me down. You've always seemed comfortable, obviously, as a singer and with your vocal abilities, but, you know, kind of matching up your personality with, you know, being a front man and sort of the, you know, the stereotypical trappings that come along with it, where it's like, oh, the singer wants to be the center of attention, and, you know, oh, everyone is going to recognize the singer of the band. Was that something that you had to kind of, you know, adjust to, as far as like, oh, like, I guess I am going to get this attention, or, you know, kind of the sort of reluctant frontman syndrome that I kind of, you know, I see other people have to like learn how to do? Is that something you had to, you know, kind of grow into?
You know, maybe a little bit, because Tom, our other guitar player, like he sang most of the songs earlier on. He when we performed, he was always in the center, and slowly it sort of like just kind of morphed in this place where I was singing more often than he was. I think just as a band, we just decided, you know, I should be, whoever's singing more should probably be in the center.
Like, logically speaking, of course.
Well, right. I mean, I sort of wrestled with that. I was like, well, look at Pavement.
Right.
Like, he doesn't do that. Like, they don't have to fucking do that. That's,
we could be wherever we want.
We could be wherever we want. Yeah. Look at Fugazi, doesn't do that. Like, so it's not cliche if it didn't work. Like, people, it just helps with the overall communication of what you're, of the music, I think, to present it in that way. So we tried it, and it seemed like it worked a lot better. We had a guy that was on the road with us helping out selling stuff, and he was like a little bit older than all of us, and he was like he had my back on it. Like, well, I didn't fight it, but I was not vocal about it, but I was definitely like, why do we have to do this? He was like, no, it works. I was like, oh, okay, whatever,
I guess I can't fight this.
It's just what it is. Like, I don't, it's just part of playing music that you're out there, that happens to be the case. And singing is, I like singing, and it's the way I think about music, is a lot of like, you know, singing is a big part of it.
Being the center of attention is a byproduct. Obviously, that was never your, you know, ego-driven goal. It was just a pure function of how you wanted to express yourself.
Yeah, it's just a pure function of playing music that I happen to be the dude who sings.
Right, right. And tell me this, too, because I've always noticed this as well, where by default, I think a lot of people turn to the singer of the band as being like the business person, you know, the most savvy, the one that's like booking the shows or doing that sort of stuff. Any of those responsibilities, like on the earlier days, you know, fall on your shoulders? Were you kind of like the hustle guy to put stuff together, whether it's like shows or, you know, finding releases and that sort of stuff?
No, our drummer, Zach, he's always been that guy.
And no one obviously looked to you towards that. It was like, oh no, that's not Jim. That's Zach. That's his deal.
Yeah. Yeah. That was always his role.
You always need at least one person in the band to be able to do that. Cause otherwise it's, you know, you're herding cats at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. One person needs to be like that. Yeah. That's kind of like the side gig for your side gig.
Right. Yeah. So you would probably properly define him as like the band dad, so to speak.
The band internal manager.
Referencing your earlier years, obviously, with the, you know, the first full length, and I'm not referencing Static Prevails, the full length that obviously, you know, was a complete representation of what you guys were doing as a early punk band. Do people bring that up to you often as far as like, I can't believe you guys used to sound like this, whatever. I defined it as kind of, you know, adorably bad, where it was like you guys were obviously finding your feet as musicians and obviously what you wanted to do musically, but there wasn't any, you know, illusions of grandeur about what you were doing with that first full length.
Right. It was just basically high school kids making music that sounded like their record collection.
Right, right.
That was, you know, and the loftiest goal that we ever had was actually recording it. So it was kind of like, you know, like that's what you
achieved
get.
Your goal. Right, right. When was the last time you listened to that?
Oh man, stuff? I don't know, like a couple of years ago, maybe.
Because that's one of my favorite things in order to, you know, kind of suss out how intimate of a bond that a person has with your particular band. Where it's like, do you know they have a full length before Static Prevails? And they're like, no. And it's like, well, just look around.
Don't look too hard though, because it sucks.
No, exactly.
You know, actually, it doesn't suck. It's just like, you know, I mean, come on, you can't like for what we knew how to do and where we were in life. It's like that's the best we could do, man. You know, like, and we maxed it out for what we knew how to do and what we were capable of. You know, you can't judge. We're really going to go and judge everything that you've ever done based on with the standard that you hold yourself to now. It's like, it's kind of, you'll just drive yourself insane.
Oh yeah. Honestly, it's irresponsible. It's a complete, I mean, that's essentially for all intent and purposes, like, you know, your guys' demo to the world, you know? And so it's like getting, no matter whose first recorded output, like, is always going to be like what you define as probably the worst thing ever. retroactively, you could find maybe charming elements of it, but there's no way that people are like, dude, my demo is probably the best thing I've ever done.
There's those people out there.
Really? I mean, I know there's the adage of like, oh yeah, their demo was the best thing. Like that whole sort of, you know, elitist, I knew them before you sort of attitude, but maybe just from like an internal, like your own musical output, there's no way that people are going to ever reference their original demo as being the superior product.
Us, no.
So as you were, you know, going through high school and then started to, you know, go to college and everything, because you studied journalism, right?
Yeah.
Did you, like, were you engaged with school at all? Or was it one of those things, like, it was just kind of like you were simply biding your time as you were kind of going through high school and then having to go to college?
No, I mean, I put effort in. I tried to do my best job at it, you know, like, I'm still kind of figuring out what it is I was passionate about and wanted to do. But, you know, I knew that I needed to engage to have a shot. Or the best shot I could get.
Was there any conflict between you and your parents as you were, you know, like whatever bone to pick that most teenagers have with their parents? Like, you know, was there strife in the household over, you know, what you would probably define now as, you know, silly things that you were doing?
No. Yeah. I mean, the things I got in trouble for, I definitely deserved to get in trouble for them. But it wasn't, I mean, that wasn't a lot, you know, like
simple vandalism.
Simple teenage kids pushing the boundaries and, you know, running that they can't, and then just realizing you shouldn't do that again.
Sure.
Just pretty boring, average, you know, nice, supportive growing up.
I mean, which it's nice because obviously there's that whole arena of people that subscribe to, you know, art is only created through absolute pain and, you know, anger and frustration, which obviously there's an element to that. But I've always subscribed to the fact that it's like, well, yeah, happiness is an emotion that's just as powerful as sadness. So that can be, you know, you can be creative in that space too.
Well, it's about being honest. You know, I think that's what translates. You know, it's kind of like if you can find the honesty in that, then there's going to be somebody that would probably pick up on it.
I know in other interviews you've spoken about, you know, having a I'll use air quotes here, a production company in college where you started to, you know, put on shows and start to bring, you know, bands from out of town and stuff like that. Was that surely a function of, I have a band, so I can book these shows and we can play it? Or was it the, you know, were there other desires attached to it?
No, that was just we booked a lot of shows for bands that didn't have anything to do with like things I was involved in. It was just sort of like, I don't know, it was just being involved in the scene. I don't know. It just seemed like something I could do that I could contribute to that was, it was kind of fun and got us like the social aspect of it all was fun.
What were some of the valuable lessons you learned from maybe shows that you put on that did terribly, where there was like, you know, four people and you were like, sorry, band, you know, I'm paying you out of my own wallet or whatever. What, do you remember any of those initial failings from that perspective?
Yeah, it was mostly failings, actually. I feel sort of bad for anybody that we worked with. So actually, some of the shows are pretty good. Karate actually said that our show was one of their best that they booked.
Amazing.
But there were like six people there. It was like 97
at the time too. I mean, you know, Arizona wasn't exactly it was known to be a independent music tour stop, but you know, I mean, there wasn't a ton of stuff going. I mean, it's like, you know, Groundwork, like a hardcore band, like there wasn't a ton of stuff going on there. So it's like, I'm sure in some respects you probably felt like you were trying to, you know, like you said, contribute to a scene and sort of build something for the future.
I mean, I think, and that's the way Arizona has always felt to me. It's like there's the possibility of being able to contribute here and actually make a difference. You know, there's a lot of people here, and there's a lot of people doing good work and that should be supported, but it's always been tricky to rally that sort of that mass support to kind of break out of the scene. Mm-hmm. But the scene itself is really supportive and there's a lot of really great people here.
Yeah.
But it did feel like that. You're kind of like part of something bigger than yourself by getting mm-hmm. involved in that. And the rewards from that are tangible because the expectations are just so minimal, you know, like
sure.
It's a good and bad thing. You can do whatever you want here. That's good. But the bad thing is that there's very few people who are going to care.
Totally. There's very few people that are going to notice what you're right. doing in any capacity.
So you can go ahead and do whatever you want here. Right. It's so amazing.
The world is your oyster.
Exactly.
It's just, it's a very small
world.
It's
going to be very hard for anyone else to care.
And so, you know, as you guys obviously started to, you know, play out and you started to, you know, whatever, gain some notoriety. And then obviously you guys, you know, you got signed to Capitol and, you know, you've made it clear that it was always one of those things where you always felt like, why are we given this opportunity? Like, why did someone sign us to Capitol? I'm sure there was obviously a lot of excitement when you guys were initially kind of talking to them. Was there kind of like a lot of people sort of throwing their hat in the ring as far as wanting to work with you guys from a future perspective around that time?
No, very few. We had okay. no business being on a major label when we signed that deal with them, and very few people even knew who we were.
Were independent labels talking to you guys?
Nobody knew who we were. The 2,000 people total that bought like our collection of 7-inch splits with other bands. Mm-hmm. Those people knew who we were, but beyond that, no one.
I definitely remember because at the time when Stack Prevails came out, there I was working at an independent record store, and I always kind of defined when a label is really trying to push a band by how many promotional copies they would send us. And I want to say we received at least like 5 or 6 copies of Static Prevails. And I always found it to be like, we don't need that many copies. Like, this is a small store. But usually I can also tie that directly into the fact that the label really didn't know how to present the band. So they were just kind of like, we'll just print up 400,000 posters and 10,000 promo CDs and just throw it around.
Yeah. I mean, that's the truth of the matter is that they were really good. I mean, it's a little bit different now, or maybe it's even more hyper this. They're really good at dropping the hammer drummer on a record that's moving like 30,000 a week. Mm-hmm. They have no idea what to do with something that's sold 3,000 total for. It's sort of like it's a chicken and the egg kind of thing. Like nothing is going to be good without somebody else telling them it's good. How do you get that development without development? How do you get that? How do you build up to that point where it makes sense to drop the hammer when there's no development? And pretty much the major label system back then seemed like there's really no point to do it unless you know, the best situation that what happened to us was the best situation that could have ever happened, is like we were able to make records the way we wanted to and go on tour, get that chance to find ourselves musically and, you know, challenge ourselves and become better at what we were doing, and also to naturally just get out in front of people and play and get better at that. The worst thing that could have happened is if like a song on Static Prevails went crazy. The worst thing would have been if Static Prevails would have blown up, and then we would have been like this 90s alternative band.
Especially at the time when that came out, because it's like, yeah, you would have been looking down the barrel of the second wave grunge acts that were coming out, and then looking down the barrel of what was happening in the late 90s/early 2000s, when, you know, bands like all of the, you know, the second generation emo or whatever you'd like to label that as. So yeah, you guys probably would have been in a really, really tough place if that were to occur.
Yeah, who knows what would have happened.
So was signing to Capitol just a pure function of like, well, this seems like the best option right now?
It was like, there's no one else talking to us.
Right.
Was my roommate going to put out our next record again? Like, I don't know.
Right.
Like, you know,
we got nothing else.
It was like, at the very worst, we're going to have some funny stories about going to LA.
Right.
That was the loftiest expectation we had there.
At that time too, like, were you, when were you actually able to kind of step back in regards to, like, you know, not having to come home from tour and, like, you know, work a day job? I presume that wasn't probably until a little bit later, or was it around that time when Static Prevails hit?
It wasn't until like Bleed American hit that I stopped coming home to work at the art supply store.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I assumed that, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I mean, it never seemed like we lost a whole lot of money. It wasn't like the band was putting us into debt. I mean, we weren't making anything.
It was self-sustaining.
It was self-sustaining. But I mean, we were 18 and 19, and we didn't really, and we slept, you know, slept on floors, and we had zero responsibilities or commitments. And I think Rick and Tom shared a room at a house in Tempe, and I think their rent for that room was like $100. They had bunk beds. They shared a bunk bed in a room that had $100 rent.
That's adorable. You were built for that lifestyle of having no overhead, so that way you didn't have any, you know, crushing bills to come home to.
Right.
What did your you know, as you started to pursue music, you know, heavily from being gone on tour so much, you know, how you obviously dropped out of college, were your parents kind of like, so Jim, is this really the move you're gonna make? We're kind of concerned.
They were concerned at first. I mean, when I broke down to them, like, what, here's you know, Capitol Records is interested in working with us. If we get involved in this deal with them, that means that potentially, because the first thing we did was like I guess it was kind of like a developmental sort of thing. Like, basically, they would, they gave us a little bit of money to make demos. And, you know, after a certain amount of time, like, it was up to them to say, we want to work with you, or, you know, maybe next time. I was like, you know, if that happens, that means that we're going to be, I probably won't make this a priority, and school's going to have to be on the back burner. And it was just, you know, I think like all parents, they just want, like, you know, they just wanted like me to be able to take care of myself, and the uncertainty of putting your, all your effort into one thing that's just so crazy. Mm-hmm. That was a little like shocking for them, but, you know, I was so, we were all just so young. It's like, they had the perspective to realize that, like, there's still time to get your act together.
Right. If this crashes and burns, they're only going to be like 21 years old.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, you'll know it pretty quick. And honestly, you know, what 21-year-old really has their act together anyway. Like, it's kind of.
Right. No, true.
You know, like, really, you're 18 and you're saying, and you know exactly what you want to do for the rest of your life. That's probably yeah. going to be open to some change in that, because there's probably going to be some things that happen real soon that will inform you otherwise.
Right. Yeah. Real life may come crash down on you, and you'll have to completely change your plan.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's okay, but there's time for that.
With Clarity, you've often mentioned, you know, that you guys all kind of saw the writing on the wall, where it was like, All right. Well, this probably will be the last time that we can do all this crazy stuff in the studio. And so we might as well just soak this experience up for what it is. Were you guys kind of, you know, having a sort of contingency plan in your own heads, whether you were executing it from the, you know, business management perspective is a different story. But were you guys in your own heads being like, all right, so we're just going to kind of return to the, you know, whatever, like signed to Big Wheel Recreation or signed to, you know, a larger independent label and then kind of exist from that perspective? Maybe not as a band collectively, but did you in your own head have any sort of those future plans?
No, there was zero planning of any future. Right. It was just like, you know, it might never get a chance to rent Timpani. So let's do that. It's tough to say because like, if you look at what's happened to the band over time, it does look like this sort of wild ride of ups and downs and uncertainty and, you know, what did you do when they dropped you? And like, but from our perspective, like it was always an upward trajectory from the earliest days of Static Prevails onward. It was like, you know, we were putting in the work and touring and always there's always somebody that was willing to put out like a record for us. And we would play shows. The next time we'd come back to town, there'd be more people, or we would have a better, you know, we would be supporting somebody bigger. It's like, and this is just the way it was going. We didn't think that like there was any cause for alarm at any point, and it was still super fun. Why would you think about a backup plan for that?
No, that's a really important point that you've exemplified, because yeah, from an outsider's perspective, and I include myself in that, where it's like, I look at all the, you know, the business travails you guys have been through. You guys had a reason to remain positive because you were seeing sort of the fruits of your labor paying off just in the sheer support of your music from a live show perspective, where you felt that there was still momentum, even though crazy stuff was happening with, you know, your labels and stuff. You're just like, well, whatever, as long as we find another person to put out our next thing when we're ready to put it out, then that's all we can hope for.
Yeah. You know, we were having fun, and every step of the way, the amazing things that we were getting to do were what we were focusing on. It wasn't like disappointment in record sales. It wasn't disappointment. It wasn't disappointment in anything. It was just, you know,
sort of steady as she
it
goes.
It was just pinch yourself. Like, can you believe we're doing this the entire time? There's not room. There's not room to get bummed out on what you're missing if you're constantly stoked on what you have.
To be honest, it's a rare mentality. I think that what you guys have all collectively put your heads in like that, many bands don't experience that usually. And even humans, like, you're always looking for what you don't have. You're like, well, that person's got that thing, man, I wish we had that. And then you get that, and then you're like, oh, but that other person has that other thing.
Yeah. That's like, getting really upset about someone not showing up at your front door with a briefcase of money.
Totally.
Like, you know, like, well, it's like, you know, it's just sort of like deluding. It's delusion, you know. It's like, boy, it'd be sure awesome if somebody came to my front door with a whole bunch of money and just handed it to me. That'd be great, right? And then, right. And then, you know, like, oh yeah, you find yourself thinking about that over and over again, and it still hasn't happened yet. And then finally, you start resenting that person for not showing up. And then you finally, it creeps in and it just poisons your whole life.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
And it's just not worth it.
Yeah, no, it's an incredibly important lesson to kind of live by. Obviously, as the band started to, you know, when you reached your kind of, you know, commercial peak was obviously, Bleed American in regards to the sheer exposure of the band. You know, I'm sure there's like, you know, a few defining moments during that record cycle where you were having those sort of like pinch me moments. I'm sure it was on a daily basis. Are there any that stick out in your head in regards to like, just the sort of out-of-body experience, surreal, we're playing, you know, Saturday Night Live or whatever. Like, we're doing these things that are just like, they don't make any sense to us because we're just a terrible band from Arizona or whatever.
The whole time was like that. Saturday Night Live was definitely the highlight of that surrealness, for sure. It's like, oh, yeah, there's Cameron Diaz.
We're over here.
It's like, oh, I just talked to Philip Seymour Hoffman. He said he'd never heard us before, but he likes our band. That happened. Hey, Will Ferrell's like, hey, you did a good job, man. Yeah, cool, man. Thanks, bro. Who am I that's doing this? Like, what just happened? Maybe playing our first sold-out show at Brixton Academy in London. That was another kind of out-of-body weirdness because, you know, just the fact that people outside of, you know, internationally would respond to it. I mean, that was a huge, bizarre thing. And, you know, at the time, all that stuff is sort of happening. You're just kind of going with it because it's just insane.
You have no time to react to it.
No, it wasn't until I feel like long after we got off the road and had started working on the Futures album that any of it sunk in.
Right. I definitely remember that time too, where it was like, you know, a lot of people who were, you know, quote unquote diehard Jimmy World fans that obviously had celebrated, you know, all of your earlier splits and recordings and stuff like that, started to, you know, whatever, develop an attitude where it was like, of course, because now Jimmy World's like fucking sellouts, like they're played in, you know, soundtracks and the radio or whatever. And so you started to see this weird dividing line at shows where it was like, you know, I mean I fortunately never fell into that camp because I was still just like, You guys are great. Keep doing what you're doing. I don't care who's coming to the shows as long as you guys still get to do what you do. Did you guys have any sort of, you know, I wouldn't even say negative feelings in your own heads, but did you notice that sort of like, you know, push and pull of like, well, I'm sorry if you can't follow us anymore because you feel like we're not, you know, the band we used to be or whatever. Or did you guys just kind of like keep your heads down and just do what you do?
There's been an underlying element of that, like since the beginning, because of our affiliation with Capitol. You know, we'd be selling records at a fucking like hardcore fest that we were playing, getting all sorts of crazy looks from the dude with like neck tattoos and plug earrings, with his distro set up at a table right next to our thing that had a big Capitol logo on it.
Uh-huh.
You know, like that's been our entire career as a band.
Right. And so, yeah, everyone always reflects on the like, did these guys really pay their dues? Like that's the argument that I find so hilarious, where it's like, no one can throw stones at you guys because it's just like, well, like we've done everything. It just happened to be that we signed a Capitol. Like, I'm sorry that was a thing back then, but you obviously, you know, you in your own head didn't letting that issue linger in your own head too long.
Yeah. Cause I guarantee you that anybody with an issue like that has never had to face that sort of dilemma for themselves. Anyone that would sort of judge or push that on somebody else hasn't. They either have issues with it on their own, or they've just never actually had to deal with that.
Sure, they're projecting. Yeah, That's a good point. Obviously, almost everybody in every interview that you've done for the past like 5 years always is like, hey, man, what's the secret sauce about your band staying together? Like, do you guys, you know, just like, you know, keep everything separate when you're at home and like all that sort of, you know, again, projections that are placed on you guys. But you do seem like each individual member seems to kind of strike that that good balance between being rooted in kind of the real world, you know, where it's like, yeah, you're going grocery shopping and you're living in the world that everybody exists in. And then also being able to, you know, exist in this hyper reality of being a rock band. I presume that that is very deliberate on your guys' part to be like, well, this is just our life. Like when we're, you know, when we're home, we're engrossed in these things and we're, you know, being with our families and we're doing all this stuff because that kind of the enjoyment that we get out of playing in a band.
Yeah. I think the people that are very different are much higher than us on the scale of stardom. You know, the people whose lives have to are when we were doing gigs, opening up for Blink-182 and Green Day, when Bleed American was starting to get some juice, it was like, you know, those other guys, other people in the other band had security. They needed it because they would get mobbed everywhere they went. And I don't know exactly why it is, if it's just the way we've public image that is kind of like always followed us around, or our desire not to necessarily chase a public image at all. But now I get recognized sometimes like at concerts because mm-hmm. I mean in like local sometimes, but it's like no one knows who we are. No one cares who we are. Like our lives are normal. Like,
well, it's funny. I'm not gonna lie. This was definitely a really nerdy thing for me to admit. But again, like I mentioned earlier, it's like my grandma lives in Phoenix, and I 100%. This was like, I don't know, a Thanksgiving two ago. I totally saw you at a Whole Foods, and it was one of those things where I was just like, do I want to be that sort of Punisher guy where it's like, hey, Jim, I really like your band. And I was like, I'm just going to leave you alone. I'm sure you would have been nice about it and it would have been fine. And like you said, it doesn't happen very often, but it's like, you always have that inner dialogue where, you know, you don't know what that person's experiencing and, you know, you're grocery shopping. You don't want to be, you know, bugged by some dude like me being like, oh, I love your band.
No,
you know?
No, it's totally fine. Like I'm fanatical about music and there's people I really look up to and I know what that feels like. So right. I would never be, if someone's approached me in that regard, like I get it. It's like, it's a little bit weird cause it's me, but you know, I get right. it.
Totally. I think you did hit a good point there where it was like the fact that, you know, there really isn't any, for lack of a better term, like pageantry about what Jimmy Eat World does. Like, you know, you guys get up on stage, you play, like you wear clothes that you wear the whole day. Like there's nothing about it that screams, you know, unapproachable. Because of that display, people are less apt to be like, oh, there's probably a darkness inside that band, or there's probably something, you know, crazy happening. Where it's like, if you guys were obviously, you know, whatever, dressing up like Def Leppard, there would obviously be a lot more to talk about.
Exactly. The whole train wreck aspect of what we do is just completely diffused. Like it's a non-starting conversation. There's not going to be, you know, there's just no juicy like story there that people can run with. And that sort of confounded media for a time. People were scratching their heads with us about like, where does this fit in? You know, like,
do we put them in Us Weekly? No, we can't do that. Where do we put them?
I don't know. Four dudes. How am I going to sell this? It's been a hindrance. That's been, you know, looking back on things, it held us back somewhat that there wasn't like that we suffered from the collective soul syndrome somewhat.
I think that's probably the first time that word has been spoken. The collective soul syndrome. I love it.
Yeah, that's going to be my new band name. Collective soul syndrome.
You should actually just take your solo act out like that. Yeah. It's perfect.
But you know what I mean though? It's like if you start chasing the approval of some uncertain listenership, like that's just, it doesn't seem honest. And yeah, it might buy you a little bit of extra story time, but it's not, you're going to build, I mean, I don't know. We've been able to do exactly what we want for over 20 years because we were just honest about who we were, what we liked, and how we as music fans wanted to present what we do as music fans ourselves. And we've just kind of stuck to that without any sense of trying to chase like a look or an image, sound.
It just resonates longer. And that's obviously why, you know, I mean, I'm just using myself as an example because that's, I could speak from experience where it's like, you know, when I got into you when you were, you know, when I was 16 years old or whatever, that's why I can still genuinely like what you guys do, because there's, you are a quantifiable commodity in the fact that your next record is going to be different, but not so different as to the point where it would be like, oh, dude, like now you guys are, you know, like a heavy band, you know, like you're not making these drastic departures that alienate people. All you're doing is just building on your sound and refining it, you know?
Yeah, we should totally make a Biohazard record next.
Right. I don't see why you can't release some version of a hardcore slash heavy music project that you guys do on your own.
Yeah, I mean, we got the metal kid inside of us all.
Right, exactly.
Like our demographic, I think, like guys our age, like there's going to be, you just have, I mean, I don't know any guy my age escape their youth without like a really intense metal phase.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's kind of like a rite of passage in a way. There's two last things I want to hit on before I let you go was the fact that you guys are all still, you know, located in Arizona and you all live there. Something that I've always admired about what you guys have done too is the strong affiliation that you guys have towards, you know, supporting the, not only the local scene, but just kind of, you know, Arizona as a whole. Because I think a lot of, you know, a lot of bands that get to a certain level, they fracture apart. Dudes move here, dudes move there, that sort of stuff. The band becomes less identifiable with a particular city. But you guys have obviously rallied around that fact, and you in particular. I presume that's a very deliberate focus where you're just like, no, I like living here, so there's no reason for me to be anywhere else.
I've always thought, like, what are you going to do in L.A.? What are you going to do in New York? I mean, really, what do you get out of that? It's well, with here, it's like I know everybody. I can do what I want to do. It's not hard to, like, piece together some sort of weirdo, like, music project if I want to try it. You know, it's very easy to set up, like, I can do, like a you know, a benefit or a charity gig anytime I want. Like, and it's pretty easy to set up. And I know most of the people that are, I don't know, it's just easy here. Like, I can do what I want.
What's the benefit?
Yeah, am I
right?
Gonna get, how, what am I going to get out of being, like, the smallest fish in the pond in L.A.? You know, I'm just another motherfucker who moved here to make it. Like, really? Like,
right.
I mean, what are you going to get out of that? Like, there's no, and now even especially, like, good music transcends all. With your ability to be your own record producer and worldwide distributor with your phone, like there's, I mean, really, what do you gain out of that? I mean, maybe you gain life experience out of that. Like, don't get me wrong, like those are, you know, big, in big, crazy, bustling places are especially if you're younger, like that's an amazing life experience opportunity. But don't kid yourself, like you, it's what you do with that experience that matters, and you don't need to be someplace. The idea that just moving someplace is going to fix or catapult you is silly, because it's always going to be with inside you, no matter where you are.
No, that's true. Like sheer proximity to something isn't going to define or necessarily facilitate that sort of success. It will just maybe make it easier to drive to auditions or whatever it is you're trying to do, but that doesn't mean you actually get that if you don't have it, like you said, inside of you.
Right. It's like what's the goal of your, basically make your decisions based on reality. Is it just complete delusion? Am I doing this for experience so I can take that and do with it no matter where I am? Mm-hmm. Like that's just kind of like what I've thought about, like living here. It's like I can, if it got to the point where I felt like I couldn't do what I wanted to do, then I would look for someplace else to work. But I got a lot of friends here and a lot of families right here, you know, like my life is more or less here.
Support the local scene.
Yeah, people did, promoters, other bands, they, you know, took a chance on us and helped us out. So there's good people doing good work here, and you know, they deserve a shot. And like I said, it's a little bit tough to get that critical mass to break out. We try our best to help out with that.
Yeah, for sure. The last thing I want to hit on was the fact that, like, you know, I mean, how long have you been married now?
13 years.
13 years. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, because I know that's always like, oh, wait, how long? Okay, yeah.
I was just hoping I didn't mess that up when I answered that.
It's okay. If you did, I would have, we could have retaken that question. And you have three kids, right? You have like 10 or 11 year old?
Yeah, 12, 10, and 6.
And so, you know, how does it sit in your kids' heads as far as like, do they think what you do is cool? Or is it one of those things that you're obviously kind of waiting for the rebellion to kick in, where it's like, oh, dude, dad's music is so lame, and like that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
You know, how does that all interplay?
I'm still
in your
cool
head?
We're not at the point yet. It's funny. I'll help in the classrooms and like my kindergartner's class. People will be like, "Are you really a rock star?"
How do you respond to that?
I'm like, "What do you expect? What do you think I should look like?" Because I don't look like I'm from the Guitar Hero. I'm not, I don't know what these little kids expect to.
Right. Like you're supposed to show up with like, you know, Liberty spikes and like this, you know, like flame jacket or something
exactly.
like that.
Then it'd be like, whoa, your dad really is a rock star.
He just looks like a lame dad. Like that's boring.
Yeah. There's another dad that I'm buddies with. And I came into my son's class and I was doing like Christmas songs, like when he was in a kindergarten. And, you know, then I was going to my other kid's class to help out with their Christmas party. He's like, so he thought I was like the school music teacher. I was like,
so good.
I'm
in a band. Yeah. I do this for like my job. Yes. Oh, really? Oh, so you teach guitar?
Oh, so yeah, you're the substitute music teacher.
That's incredible. I presume that's probably one of the hardest components of what it is you do for a living to, you know, kind of uproot yourself and leave your family for a prolonged period of time. But I'm sure there's some semblance of like, we know that dad has to do this. And, you know, there's that desire for when you come home, it's going to be that much sweeter.
It's definitely a mixed bag getting what you want. You know, that's just the trade-off in it. Yeah. As the kids get older, and their problems become more young adult, it means it's a big deal to show up for them. With what I've been able to do, you know, it requires me to put a lot of time in and a lot of, you know, distance from them, because, you know, we don't make the kind of money where it's like you can just bring the whole family on the road for the tour. You know, it's like, I look at it like this. It's a sacrifice to do it. You better have fun with it.
If you're going out there and you're not, you know, embracing it for what it is, then yeah, you're going to return home miserable and you're going to be, you know, a terrible husband and a terrible father. And it's just going to be this horrible cycle you enter. Well, Jim, I will let you go, but I really, really appreciate you, you know, kind of having these conversations and talking about a few things. I hope I haven't bored you with these questions.
No, it's all good, man.
So that is what Jim and I spoke about and recorded and am presenting to you now. Thank you very much for listening and hanging out. Like I said, special thanks to my friend Steve, and special thanks to Jim for doing this, because I wanted to really make sure this month of April was like huge guest after huge guest. So I hope that we are delivering, and we will continue to deliver, because it is the fundraising month, like I said. So last urge and last, I would say implore, which that is the sign of the word, but last push, just visit the show notes of the show and you will be able to see two links that will take you to a place where you can donate to this show. I would really appreciate if you considered that and thought about it and ultimately did it. That would be nice. The producer, as always, for this show is Tom Richfield, who is doing a bang-up job on these things, because sometimes these conversations are quite long and he has to make them into a tight hour if he can. Visit the show's website, 100wordspodcast.com, and you can actually sign up to a little email blast that I send out once a week on the right side of the page. You can just type in your email address. And tune in next week for another awesome show in our great fundraising month. And then, yes, the third-year anniversary. It's coming up right around the corner. I think it's actually, it's like May 6th, so the first week of May, you'll be getting some fun sort of facelifts to the show. So anyways, until next week, please be safe, everybody.
The show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Trust me in saying that no matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all of the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.